Let's welcome Charlie Dyer.
Thanks, Greg. Well, it's been a fun time here at Mount Hermon with everybody. You need to know what I've enjoyed, especially, and I didn't have a chance to tell him, were Bob's stories about his dogs. I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, so I was up in the northeast where Bob was, and grew up with dogs. Now, the big difference, though, is as Bob Chisholm was sharing about his dogs, not just Mickey, the one that he told us about this morning, but his other dogs, I kept thinking of our dog, Ginger. Greg knows Ginger. Ginger, picture all those things that the Bob's dogs did, and then do the opposite, and you have Ginger. Gary Larson, The Far Side, had a cartoon, and actually had Ginger in it. And it said, what you say, and it says, bad dog, Ginger. You shouldn't do that, Ginger. And then what they hear, blah, 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 Ginger, blah, 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 Ginger. That was our dog. But I have a story about the animals. Now, his story today was a little bit gruesome with those woodchucks. In my story, no animals are harmed. But Ginger, woodchucks would have been too much for her. She didn't have that sneak around in the back. But we did have a squirrel in our backyard. And so for entertainment value a little bit, I didn't like the squirrel particularly running around my house. But we'd say, Ginger, squirrel. And she would just become this vicious animal. And we'd go over and open the door, and Ginger would shoot out at the squirrel. And the squirrel would begin running, and Ginger would blindly run at the squirrel. Well, the squirrel went about 15 feet and then jumped up in the tree. Ginger kept running after that squirrel and was about 10 feet beyond the tree till she realized, wait, there's no squirrel anymore. It never dawned on her that the squirrel could go up a tree. That was Ginger. We managed to cause other problems for other dogs with our Ginger. We babysat our pastor's dog, and our pastor's dog was a very proper pastor's dog. When you would put out the meal for the pastor's dog, it would come over and it would take a bite of the little chunks of stuff and go off and kindly chew it and then eventually come back and take another bite. Ginger, meanwhile, would say, it's a bowl. And after she ate hers, she'd look over and the other dog was gone. She'd go, I guess she didn't want it. That poor dog just began huddling around its meal. When the pastor was telling us to get home, he said, wonder what happened. She doesn't walk away anymore. She just kind of stands there. Well, she was starving to death because of our dog. So I don't have any terrific stories like Bob, but Ginger brings back fond memories. Our kids called her Thundertail. She was a mixture of a lab and a beagle. So if you can picture a long-legged beagle that's tanned, with the nose of a beagle and the markings of a lab, and great for our kids. But I always kidded our youngest child, and I said, one of these days, you know, you're going to be gone, the dog's going to die, and we're going to be free. And it all happened, same summer. So they accuse us of kind of hastening Ginger's demise. But we didn't. Well, those are my dog stories, and that's all I have. And right now, there's not a living thing in our house. No pets, no plants, no nothing, which is how we can just block up and head off to a place like Mount Hermon and be with you. But what I want to do is talk not about dogs or pets or plants or anything else, but I want you to head in your Bibles to 1 Samuel 24, because we're going to talk about David's encounter with Saul at En Gedi. Now, it was Howard Hendricks, and I know he's been here, and I know those of you who heard him love him. He put his fingerprints on so many of us at Dallas Seminary. But I heard him one time as he talked about the saying that went out throughout the land in Israel, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And Hendricks's observation on it is, from that point on, David had a critic. And what a critic it was. It was the top dog, the head banana, the head honcho, the guy in charge, the king, who made it his point to get this guy that he no longer liked. David was fine as a musician, fine when he slayed Goliath, but the minute David got top billing, Saul became the critic for him. You know, live a life of integrity, live a life of faithfulness, and if you do that long enough, you're gonna end up with your share of critics, people who just don't like you. They for whatever reason, don't like what you do. They don't like your work. They attack your reputation. They're just out to get you because they, for some reason, don't like you. So how do you handle someone who just in their life seeks to be your major adversary, your major critic. How do you handle critics like that? And that's what we're going to see in 1 Samuel 24. Now, I need to say very quickly, handling critics is not the same thing as handling criticism. Criticism done properly is pointing out problems for the sake of making us better. And again, we don't always like that, but criticism can be very, very positive, very helpful. Critics are out to destroy an individual. They're there just to get the person, not to improve them, not to help them, but they're responding in a negative reaction, often irrationally, to the individual. How do you handle someone like that who's just out to attack you? And I think we're going to see a good example of that in 1 Samuel chapter 24 as we look at David and Saul and En Gedi and the question, how do we handle critics? So let me take you there first and set the stage. What I want to do is just very briefly review part of last night. We looked at En Gedi quickly and then Masada last night. I want to circle back to En Gedi again. En Gedi, halfway down the Dead Sea on the western shore of the Dead Sea. Now, if you were flying in an airplane, this is what En Gedi would look like. It's really a barren place. It is a very difficult place. It's rugged, and once you climb up the hillside, the cliff face of En Gedi, you've still got to go through the Judean wilderness, an incredibly inhospitable place. And yet, there was a major road that went from Moab to Jerusalem that came across the Lisan at the Dead Sea by Masada, came up to En Gedi, worked its way up in through those cliffs on a switchback, and then went across the wilderness to Jerusalem. That's En Gedi. Now, last night we said it's about 10 miles from Masada to En Gedi, but if you're standing at En Gedi, you can look and in the distance see the mesa that is Masada. From Masada, you can look off in the distance and 10 miles away see a little splotch of dark that is En Gedi. But that's where we're standing, and what we want to do then is look up the oasis itself. It's an oasis because there are several springs that come together at that spot. It's the rain that fell up in the hill country that seeped through its way through the limestone that breaks out right here that provides the water, the nourishment, that provides the greenery, which is why the animals are there and why there's today a kibbutz there, a Jewish settlement, and why in the days of David and Saul, David ended up at En Gedi. Now, we wanted to go up inside there and look up into the distance. There's the waterfall that's in En Gedi today. Just a little ribbon of water, but when you're in the wilderness, any water is a good thing. Streams in the desert, as the Bible sometimes refers to it, is what you find at En Gedi. The ibex are there because En Gedi means spring of the wild goats. And the wild goats are these ibex that are still around. They're protected now. But in David's day, they would have still been roaming through that area as well. And in David's day, as a shepherd, he would have known about En Gedi to bring his sheep down to find water out in the wilderness. You go up on the way to En Gedi, and it's just beautiful. You have the main waterfall, and then as that water cascades down through the valley, several pools are there, places where someone on the run could stop and get refreshed. You continue working your way up, and you get almost to this cliff face at the end, and there's that waterfall. There's that water cascading down that is absolutely refreshing while you're there. Now, Saul, oops, and I go back one. I clicked my finger too fast. Saul understood all of that. So let me go back. Here he is. Saul understood all of that. In fact, when I start 1 Samuel 24, after Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En Gedi. He's in the wilderness area, and En Gedi's where he's hanging out. That's the water supply where David is hanging around. And Saul says, in essence, I got him. I know where he is, and there are only so many places he can hide there. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crag of the wild goats. En Gedi's the spring of the wild goats. Saul's there looking for him near the crag of the wild goats. This picture is being taken from just up above. As Saul approaches En Gedi, this is what it would look like down below. The water would be at the bottom of this picture, cascading down. You can't see the water. Well, you can a little bit in the picture if you're up close to it, but you can certainly trace where the water is by following the flow of green right along its edge. Saul knew where David would be. He might not know exactly where he is, but it's a narrow valley, and David can only hide so many places. 3,000 men to smoke David out. Saul said, I've got him. So Saul approaches En Gedi. He's there looking for David. In fact, as they go out, they finally reach that spot. Well, then the next thing that happens, it says, is He came to the sheep pens along the way, and a cave was there, and Saul went in to literally cover his feet. My Bible has to relieve himself. All along this edge are caves. Now, some are larger than others, but Saul just happens to pick one and decides, I need a potty break. Now, there are two possible translations, by the way, of covering his feet. And I'll be as delicate as I can be. One is that some would say, well, Saul needed a nap. A little siesta, it's hot. And so you go in, when you take a nap, you take a blanket and you throw it over your leg. You cover your feet. You need to know, you wouldn't be wearing a blanket at En Gedi. It's a figure of speech, but if it's what Saul's doing, it would mean he's napping. But if he's napping, he's napping while his 3,000 soldiers are out in the sun, rather brutally. That's possible. The other expression is, though, when it says that, and it's used elsewhere in the Bible, when you covered your feet, it was the kind of euphemism we would use, like when we say, you went to the WC, he went to the restroom. We don't go to that room to take a rest, by the way, but it's a euphemism. Now, that euphemism came from a very practical thing. Remember, they all wore those long robes, and so if you were covering your feet, you were using the squatty potty. So it's a euphemism. Saul needs to relieve himself, and that's probably the best translation today. Saul needs to relieve himself. There happens to be a nearby cave. He's having a problem, and so Saul enters the cave. If you've ever gone in a cave like that, from being out in the bright sunlight, you can barely see. Saul's blinded by the darkness in the cave, but he looks in, tries to find a quiet spot in there to take care of his business. What he doesn't realize, as the text says it, there in David and his men were far back in the cave. They were, and literally it's on the sides. David and his men were crouched on the sides, hiding into the dark shadows of that cave. It's a large cave to have that many men inside. Before, the odds were in Saul's favor with his 3,000 men. Now the odds are in David's favor. And suddenly David's presented with probably the most unique opportunity of his short career up to that point. Saul has been chasing him. Here's the chance to end it all. Saul chose the cave at random. Certainly that looks as if God's hand's in it. And that's it. It's at this point when we start saying, how do you really handle a critic? Someone who's out to get you. What do you do when you face that individual, when you confront that individual? What happens in that interaction? How does David handle this critic, Saul, who's been after him for so long? Well, watch what happens. The first thing I see is that David refused to retaliate. David did not sink to the level of Saul in how he responded to Saul. Read in verse 4 and in verses 6 to 7. In verse 4, the men said to David, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I'll give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" By the way, try and find that as a reference in the Bible. If God had said that to David, he never said it anywhere that's written in the text. Now, we knew that God had chosen David. God had promised to deliver David. And his friends take that and kind of extrapolate it and say, "Hey, David, when God told you you're going to be king, when God told you you take care of your enemies, this has to be what God was talking about. God has given Saul into your hands. You've got him." That's verse 4. Verses 6 and 7, I'm skipping verse 5 for just a second. But in verses 6 and 7, he said to his men, though, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he's the anointed of the Lord." David refuses to take the opportunity to get back at Saul. Saul would have killed David in a heartbeat if he had the chance. David doesn't respond the same way. All of us, it's very difficult. If you've been harmed by someone, if you've been hurt by someone who's constantly after you, it's very hard not to lash back, not to respond in kind. But David says, no, wait a minute. He's still the Lord's anointed. God has still put him there, and I'm not going to respond to Saul the way Saul's trying to respond to me. Now, David uses an interesting phrase. He talks about the hand. Far be it that I should extend my hand. In fact, in narrative literature, when you're reading through the Bible, since in narrative it doesn't always tell you what the point of the story is, you've got to be careful and observe the details of the story, because it's in observing the details that you can sometimes get the point of the story. In this case, the word hand keeps being used again and again and again in the story of David and Saul. The hand represents our physical power. It's the might that we have. It's in many ways the control, the authority. I've got you in my hand. Watch how it's used in this. David's friends say to him, I will give your enemy into your hand. That's the promise God has. You have Saul in your power. This is the time to get him. David's response, the Lord forbid that I should lift my hand against him. In verse 10, David says to Saul, I said, I will not lift up my hand against my master. As he goes on in the chapter, verse 11, look at this piece of robe. We'll come back to this again, but David says, look at this piece of robe in my hand. There's no evil or rebellion in my hand. What's in my hand is a piece of robe. That could have been your heart, Saul, but there's no evil or rebellion in my hand. I had you in my power. I chose not to use it. My hand will not touch you, David says in the next verse. He says, lest Saul miss the point. The next verse, my hand will not touch you. I could have gotten you. I chose not to do it because I don't respond that way. David finally ends in the end of his speech, which is a rather long speech, by the way. David says, may the Lord vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. You wanted me. I'm trusting God to take care of me, but I'm not going to take vengeance into my hand against you. At the end of the chapter, Saul finally responds. He says, the Lord delivered me into your hands, but you didn't kill me. It's as if Saul's amazed at that, because certainly that's not how he would have responded. Finally, Saul admits, the kingdom will be established in your hand. He recognized, at least for a fleeting instant, that indeed David was the bigger man and that God had taken the kingdom away from him and given it to David. David was going to control what Saul had hoped would be his and his family's. Hand used over and over again. By the way, that's chapter 24. If you go back to chapter 23, you find the same thing. You go into chapter 25 and 26, the same thing. This idea of control, David and Saul, at least from Saul's perspective, he sees David wrestling control from him, or God taking it away, and Saul wants to keep it, and he figures the way to do it is to get David. David refuses to play by Saul's game. He refused to retaliate. The second thing I notice in this chapter is that David remained tender-hearted. Let's go back to verse 5. David's friends are saying, hey, this is it. Get him. You have your chance. David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterwards, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. Literally, it says David's heart was smitten. He felt bad for what he had done. Now, one person tried to picture it, and I don't think it was this like this at all. It's not that David's right up next to Saul. Saul likely had taken his outer garment off, laid it off to the side. David was able to go over and just saw off a piece while Saul. Or David was able to saw off a piece while Saul was busy elsewhere in the cave. But why the corner of his robe? Why did David do that? And why did it bother him? You'll hear some people say, "Well, it's like vandalism." This is the ancient equivalent of David keying Saul's car or slashing his tires, and then he felt bad about it. But I think there's more to it than that. In fact, if you trace another one of those words in the Bible, the corner of his robe, which is what it uses here, the word for corner is the word for wing, but it means a wing or a corner, and so a corner is the better translation. That was used earlier in the book of Samuel. Saul had been disobedient. Finally, in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, Samuel had to come and Saul and say, God's getting rid of you as king. In fact, Samuel turned to leave after he tells Saul, you've been disqualified for your rebellion. When he does, Saul caught hold of, now my translation has the hem of his robe, but it's literally the corner of his robe, the wing of his robe, and it tore. And Samuel says to him, the Lord's torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Saul grabs Samuel's corner of the robe and ripped the robe. Samuel responds by saying, God's ripping your kingdom away from you. Now, that was in chapter 15. David has been on the run for a while. Very likely, he knew this story from Samuel, when Samuel anointed him. David knew that he had replaced Saul. David understood what had happened to Saul. David knew the story about Saul. Very possibly, when David came up, thinking of this verse. David crept up on notice and cut off the same word, the corner of the robe. Yeah, God said the robe's being taken, the kingdom's being taken from him. Just like that, I could do it. It would be that easy to do. One other possibility, by the way. In the Mosaic Law, Israel was told that they were to put tassels on the four corners of their garment. It was to remind them of their relationship to God. Some think that it's even possible that what David cut off was one of the tassels. In essence, disqualifying Saul from following the law of God. You disobeyed God, God's taking the kingdom from you, and right now, I could even take your life as an Israelite away. But whatever it was, what David did, whatever he was contemplating, the minute he had done it, he realized, wait a minute, that's wrong. His conscience was smitten by it. It bothered him to have done that. Saul wouldn't think twice in coming after David. David refused to respond the same way to Saul. Someone said it this way, although the kingdom was David's to receive, it was not David's to take. The satanic shortcut to kingship was a temptation. The Son of Man was also tempted to seize what only the Ancient of Days could give. You remember what happened in the wilderness with Jesus? Satan said, hey, I can give you the kingdom and you don't need the cross. I got a shortcut to get what you want. All you have to do is worship me. And Jesus refused to succumb to that temptation. David had a shortcut, or at least it looked like a shortcut, a temptation. Why go through all the suffering? Why go through all this struggle that I'm going through? And indeed, it continued on for years. Why go through it all? I could end it right now. Come out of this cave, show him the head of Saul, just like I showed the head of Goliath, and say, I'm your new leader. But David didn't do it. It was his kingdom to receive, but God never said it was his kingdom to take. That would have made David a man of blood. And he would have been no better than Saul himself. David didn't go down to Saul's level. He refused to retaliate. He remained tenderhearted. It even bothered him when he contemplated that possibility. And finally, he recognized God's sovereign control over everything that was happening. In verses 6 and 12, did you notice what David said to the men? Verse 6, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he's the Lord's anointed. Down in verse 12, almost the same thing. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you've done to me, but my hand won't touch you. You're the Lord's anointed. God's going to take care of you, and in God's sovereign time that will happen, but I'm not going to take God's role into my hands. I'm going to trust God. That's hard. That's faith. If you've ever been harmed by someone and the opportunity comes to finally settle scores, finally be vindicated at their expense, it's hard at times not to follow through, isn't it? To say, wait, I'll let God take care of it. Remember, this is all happening in that narrow valley. It would have been so easy for David, from a human perspective, to take care of it. But he couldn't, because Saul was the Lord's anointed. By the way, the word, and Bob had mentioned this in one of his messages, the word is Mashiach, Messiah. But it's Messiah with a small M. That is, Saul had been anointed, put in this place by God, and David wasn't about to take the role of God for himself. God put him there, God will take care of him, and in the meantime, I'll trust God to take care of him. We know Messiah because there's a capital M, ultimate Messiah who's coming, the Lord's anointed. But Saul was God's anointed one. Saul was God's Messiah. And even though David had also been anointed, David wasn't going to press God or try to do something against God himself. So what's David do to handle critics? Well, he refuses to retaliate. He remained tenderhearted through it all. It even bothered him when he thought about what he could do. He recognized God's in control, God's sovereign control of it all. And then when David confronted Saul, he responded with grace. The bulk of this chapter is David's defense in front of Saul. And you read this section, and I want to do it very quickly. But as David comes out and suddenly appears to Saul, by the way, I'm glad Saul had gone to the bathroom already, because when he turned around and saw David in the mouth of the cave that he had just been in, had he not gone, he would have right then. That would have been truly a frightening time. David now responds, though, and he responds with a defense. He's very, very gracious. Now he does. He shows respect to Saul. Verse 8, he says, as he comes out, he bowed with his face to the ground. He prostrated himself, it says, with his face to the ground. David does honor, respect to King Saul, rather than saying, "Hey, buddy, I could have got you, man." He starts out as a very, very respectful way. He affirms his innocence in verses 9 to 12. In fact, I love the way he does it. He says to Saul, "Why do you listen to what men say? David's bent on harming you." That's the charge. You get David because David's after you. And David says, "How can you listen to people like that? By the way, you have some eyewitness evidence against it." Verse 10, "This day you've seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hand in the cave. Some even urged me to kill you, but I said, I will not lift my hand against my master." Hey, you want some eyewitness evidence? You just saw it. I could have killed you just now, and I didn't. So how can you believe people who say, "I want you dead"? But if eyewitness evidence isn't enough, he says, look at the material evidence in verse 11. He says, "See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand." And that had to surprise Saul. "That's how much I could have gotten you. I was that close, and I chose not to kill you." He then comes to his conclusion to it all and says, "I cut off the corner. I didn't kill you. Now understand and recognize I'm not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I've not wronged you. You're hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me. May the Lord avenge the wrongs you've done to me, but my hand won't touch you. As the old saying goes, from evil comes evil, so my hand won't touch you." David is incredible as he affirms his innocence. He puts this criticism that Saul had in perspective to show how Saul was wrong, and he gives the matter over to God. David gives a very reasoned defense. By the way, sometimes when we have critics, you get so angry at them that what you really want to do is just smack them. David doesn't respond in a visceral or emotional way. He comes through very clearly and gives a rather Perry Mason-like court defense of his actions. He goes through and shows how he was innocent, and he can prove it to Saul. Well, I come back. This book, the chapter ends. So David gave his oath to Saul. Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold, which, when you go back, the last point on how you handle critics, retain your wisdom in the midst of it all. Be gracious, but don't be stupid. Saul, as I said, went home. David decides to go another direction. If Saul went back toward Gibeah of Saul, David decides to go to Masada again, just lest Saul change his mind. Well, by the way, that was a pretty good action on David's part, because in chapter 26, the Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Hey, isn't David hiding on the hillside of Hakila, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph and took 3,000 chosen men of Israel. He's back at it again. Just two chapters after, he says, I'll let you go. Yes, we're going in peace. David knew Saul wouldn't keep his word, and David showed wisdom in where he was going to go. He was going down there to En Gedi just to keep an eye out, lest Saul show up. And sure enough, two chapters later, Saul was back to his old tricks. So what lessons, though, can we get from 1 Samuel 24? I think there's two basic lessons as David handles this critic, Saul, in his life. First, the kingdom was David's to receive, but it was not his to take, which tells me the end never justifies the means. We got to remember that. In life today, even when we're in the right and someone else is in the wrong, we've got to make sure that we don't violate God's standards of right and wrong to vindicate ourselves. Let's give the matter over to God. And second, the real lesson isn't how to avoid criticism, but how to respond to critics. Don't confuse the two, because there will be people who tell you things that you need to hear that you may not want to hear. That's not critics. That's criticism. Criticism can be helpful. Critics are out to get us. And when you're confronted with critics, what you need to do is make sure that you give that matter to God and let God fight the battles while you learn how to trust him more. And with that, let's just close in prayer and commit the rest of our time here and our time heading home back to the Lord. Father, we do know that we face unjust criticism, and we have critics here in this life. We are misunderstood at times. There are individuals who just don't like us, or our stand for you, or the way we handle our lives. But Lord, none of that takes you by surprise. And I pray for myself and for all of us as we head home. Lord, remind us to put our trust in you, to let you fight those battles, to give a good account of ourselves as your children. And Lord, as we do, use our life and our words and our faith in a way that will draw others to you. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.